I picked up your book on Sunday evening, and before I finished it, I called Marley Russoff over at Houghton Mifflin, and I said, I have to talk to him, because she had mentioned that you were going to be in town this week, so I was highly impressed with the book, and I wanted to have the opportunity to talk to you and ask you a couple of questions. You taught English in Turkey, is that correct?
Yes, in Istanbul and in Izmir, for a few months in Izmir and for about a year and a half in Istanbul.
Where did you teach?
At the University of Istanbul and the British Council, occasional classes at the Council.
Would you say that again?
Occasional classes at the British Council, but my main job in Istanbul was with the university.
What was it like working and teaching in Istanbul?
Well, it was very interesting, really, at that time. That was before things started to get difficult. I mean, that was before there was a lot of student unrest. Things were peaceful and nice then. Professors weren't being attacked and so on. I liked it, and I liked teaching the Turks. But I was teaching English as a foreign language, basically, although I was doing some literature with them as well.
When was this?
Well, this was in about 1968, 69.
How did you happen to... Did you speak Turkish?
I learned to speak Turkish while I was there, after a fashion. Not fluently, but sufficient for, daily communication about ordinary things. Yes, I learned it quite well.
What, was it difficult to teach English to Turks without knowing the Turkish language?
Well, these were Turkish undergraduates doing an English degree, so they already knew English pretty well. It wasn't a question of teaching the basics. It was just a question of the refinements of the language, really.
Is Istanbul still divided into ethnic quarters in the way it was when you wrote...
Yes, to a certain extent. Pera and Galata are still more European, and old Istanbul, Stambul, over the Golden Horn, is still mainly Turkish. The division still exists, but I mean, modern Istanbul isn't anything like as cosmopolitan a city as it was in 1989 when I set my book.
Where did you live in Istanbul?
I lived in a suburb called Beşiktaş, which is on the new side, the newer side of Istanbul.
But I would imagine many of the streets and buildings that are in your novel are still in existence today, is that correct?
Yes, I used some of the streets in my novel. I lived in a street called Çitlinbik Street, and that still was there then. And Beşiktaş was still an important market and landing stage before the war, before the First World War at that time.
You are living in London now?
Cambridge. Uh-huh. Well, in fact, my home is in Cambridge, but at the moment I'm living up in Northumberland, which is, in the north of England, because I've got a writing residence thing there for 2 years. That's at the University of Newcastle.
So you're a writer in residence?
Yes.
Uh-huh. When you wrote Rage of the Vulture, you obviously you could not assimilate everything, all the historical aspects and the single year you were in Turkey, I would assume. How did you go about researching the information for your book?
Well, I'd already done quite a lot of research before that, because the book immediately previous to this one was set on a Greek island under Turkish occupation in 1908, 1909, one of those Eastern Aegean islands, which were still under the Turk until almost the outbreak of the First World War. And it was a Greek population, but a Turkish garrison. And the research and reading I did to get the period right and to get the setting right left me at the end of the book with a lot of material, really, that I hadn't used. And in the process, I'd got very interested in the period. So I decided to write another novel set at exactly the same time, but set in Constantinople. And that's really how it happened. So I'd done quite a bit of the work first. But then I continued to do historical reading and background reading, eyewitness accounts of the period and sort of memoirs, that kind of thing, to put together the picture. Because this particular book is more complicated than the last one. I mean, more politically and historically complicated. So there was quite a lot of reading necessary.
Do you like the Turks?
Yes. Yes, I like them very much. I had lots of good friends among Turks. I liked the country people better than the townspeople, I suppose. I mean, I liked the sort of simple, traditional way of life that they've still got in the countryside. And they're friendly, hospitable, warm-hearted, loyal, honest people. And I had good friends there.
And yet there's a perception that there is something unpleasant about the Turks, or at least their nature or their character. Is that accurate?
I think that's not the case. I think that the period that I'm writing about in The Rage of the Vulture was a particularly evil and corrupt period in Turkish history. It was the final decline, almost the death throes, of the Ottoman Empire after 500 years. And everything was in an advanced stage of corruption, where things were falling apart, really. Not only was it politically and morally an evil regime, it was almost what we'd call today a police state, but from all over Europe, and I suppose the United States too, adventurers and rascals and rogues of all kinds were congregating there, because there were pickings to be made. So it was a peculiar society. I think it was peculiar to that particular time. I don't think my book really relates to modern Turkey or has any relevance to the Turkey of today, or what I feel about the Turkey of today. It has to be seen, I think, in a historical perspective.
Why have the Turks had such animosity for the Greeks and indeed the Armenians?
I think the two things are different in a way. The Greek question and the Armenian question, I think, are rather different. The Greeks were an occupied nation. That is to say, the Turks took Greece over as a territory, and put the Greeks under foreign domination. They occupied the country. They exacted taxes. They garrisoned the country. But Greece was still, in a sense, a territory that was definite. But the Armenians, they hadn't a national state, because Armenia was an ancient kingdom, and it had a period of power and splendor. But at the time of the book, the people were scattered, and so there wasn't a particular national state or territory that you could say was Armenian at that time. So really the Armenians were much more integrated in the Turkish population than the Greeks ever were. I don't think the Greeks integrated much at all. They remained separate. Whereas Armenians and Turks worked side by side, and were for centuries loyal and cooperative people, though they were oppressed by the Turk. They were a subject people. And then, with the rise of nationalism in the 19th century, and with the spread of education, they began to be restless. They began to demand rights, reforms, equal opportunities, justice in the courts. And they were encouraged in these aspirations by the Western powers, especially France and England and Russia. They were encouraged rather irresponsibly, because there was no real way that those powers could do much to help the Armenians. They were too far away. And so the Turks were at liberty, with a fair degree of impunity, in fact, to suppress whatever national stirrings that arose at that time.
How many Armenians remain in Turkey today?
I should say it's difficult to say. There were, at the time of the genocide, there were roughly 2 million Armenians in Turkey, and estimates vary as to how many were actually massacred in 1915, but it was well over 1 million. So the population was more than halved, and those that weren't killed, naturally enough, scattered, and many of those with money and opportunity got out of it. I wouldn't like to say how many there are at present living there. There are still certainly a good number in Istanbul and in Izmir, in the commercial centers.
Are they still oppressed?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I should think there's hostility. After all, they're a Christian people, and the Turks, of course, are Muslim. There's still a feeling of Muslim supremacy, I think, in Turkey, in the sense that in order to be a proper citizen and a Turk, certainly, you would have to be Muslim. So there probably is that sort of friction and hostility in the community, but there's no overt oppression as far as I know.
The Armenia that we talk about today is part of the Soviet Union, but it's not doesn't really reflect the political or cultural heritage of the Armenians, does it? Hasn't it been fairly well subjugated even by the Soviets?
I think that there has been some persecution, probably, basically not on the grounds that they're Armenian, but on the grounds that they would wish to preserve a traditional way of life and a traditional way of worship. So I think I'm really speaking without precise knowledge on this.
Well, weren't they barred from using their traditional language in the Soviet Union?
Yes, I think attempts were made to suppress the language. But the Armenians are no strangers to that, because the Turks, in certain areas, tried very hard to obliterate the language. And it was only really by insisting that the language was kept alive, and even in some cases by learning it secretly, having lessons in secret under pain of quite severe punishment. I think it was only in that way that Armenia, the Armenians as a people with an identity, survived the 500 years of occupation.
Well, in The Rage of the Vulture, your protagonist, fiancé, is an Armenian, and she is murdered, and that's, I think, 1898 or somewhere in that period.
That's right, 1896.
Uh-huh. And then in 1915, after the book, after the scenes in the book, there is another slaughter of the Armenians. Why? It boggles the mind that these things happen. I mean, what prompted the Turks do something like that?
In the 1890s, the Ottoman regime, as I was saying, was crumbling, and internal divisions were making themselves felt. The government was threatened. And I think it's natural under those circumstances, unfortunately, it seems to be historically evident that it is, that the government should seek for a scapegoat. And the Armenians were a very convenient scapegoat, I think, at that time. They were a minority, they were an ethnic minority, they were religiously, they were Christian. They could be blamed for a good deal that seemed to be going wrong. And it wasn't difficult for Abdul Hamid II, that was the ruling sultan, to stimulate and provoke the fanaticism that was always lying not far below the surface. But the massacres, although they were frightful, and probably killed several hundred thousand Armenians, they were sporadic and, in a sense, inefficient. It was a kind of sporadic brutality. But the 1915... killings were of a quite different kind, because Turkey was in the war by then, and she was on the German side. She was afraid of Armenian cooperation with the Allies. She was also afraid that if the war was lost for Germany, that the Armenians would then be in a position to exact a kind of vengeance which might have been terrible after the centuries of oppression. They thought that the solution to this might, well, certainly they thought it was to get rid of them as a people. And so it was not religiously ordered. It was a secular. I mean, the orders went out from Constantinople to the provincial governors, issued by Republican Turks. And it was a much more efficient butchery, and therefore, of course, took a much greater toll on the Armenian population, because it killed a million and a half, I don't know.
Well, Turkey for ever and ever in the history of man go down in the record books as one of the nations guilty of genocide and mass murder?
I'm afraid so. I think that they started off the 20th century in a way that it was to continue in more recent times, as we know.
This week you spoke at the Armenian Church of America in Manhattan. What did you tell that crowd?
I spoke to them about my book, mainly, because I didn't really feel any right as a non-Armenian speaking to Armenians, and many of them, in fact, survivors of the massacres. There were 68 actual survivors of the massacres in the cathedral, and many other Armenians who'd lost friends and relatives. So in that situation, I didn't have much right to speak other than as a writer who had used Armenia and had been sympathetic to the cause, but had made it into a fiction. And after all, I'd in a sense exploited that situation for my own purposes. But I did express my sympathy and express the view which I hold, that until there is a recognition of this wrong, there can't really be a reconciliation and that a basis for future relationships and for the lessening of Armenian grievance and hatred for the Turk can only be laid on that basis of a Turkish acknowledgement that these things happened. And I think at the moment this acknowledgement hasn't been made.
Turkey still has the image of a repressive society. In drugs, for example, they are known for being very strict in dealing with people with drugs. Was that your perception when you taught there, that perhaps overreacted?
There were quite severe penalties for anyone found in possession of drugs, yes, quite heavy jail sentences. The smoking of hashish was fairly prevalent in Turkey itself at that time, I mean among the Turks. You would see taxi drivers carrying passengers and smoking, and the stuff would be offered to you quite casually in a cafe or something like that. I have no personal knowledge of Englishmen or of other foreigners being in trouble over it, but there were stories about it, and of course there were some cases that cropped up later on of quite young, there was quite a young boy, I think he was only 14, who was found with something and was given a jail sentence originally, I think, of about 20 years, if I remember rightly. I think that was reduced subsequently.
You want to go back to Turkey?
Very much, very much. I intend to, yes.
What are the things about Turkey and Istanbul that you like?
Well, apart from the people themselves, who I like the city. It's a beautiful city. One of the most beautiful cities in the world, it must be, with a marvelous skyline of dome and minaret, and situated on heights so that you're always aware of them as you move around the city, and they're always silhouetted there. And then, of course, the fact that it's situated really on three seas makes it fascinating, because there's an impression of water everywhere. And the restaurants are very good, and the Turks cook very well, and the wine is nice, and the climate is marvelous, especially in the spring and autumn. It's cold in the winter.
Has your book been translated into Turkey? Turkish?
No, it hasn't.
Will
I don't
be,
expect
it
to be.
No, it would be interesting
to
have a Turkish reaction to the Rage of the Vulture.
It would be very interesting.
Have you had a chance here in New York to eat in any of the Turkish restaurants?
No, not yet.
Or the Armenian restaurants?
Well, I've been treated so kindly by the Armenians they've fed me outside of restaurants quite a bit. I mean, not outside of the restaurants, but in other places, and they've looked after me very well and been very hospitable. No, I have that pleasure yet to come.
And how long will you be remaining in the United States?
Until this Saturday evening. But I think I may come back later on in the year, in the autumn, on the invitation of the Armenians to visit some other cities and perhaps meet Armenian communities in those places too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.